Hey, it's November 17th, and I'm talking to Carla McKay. Carla, how and why did you get into the psychiatric survivors movement?
Well, I got into the movement back in late 1977, early 1978. I was a first-year law student at the time, and a number of years before, back in 1963, I'd been through the experience of being hospitalized for psychiatric reasons and undergoing ECT and generally not having an awfully good time of it, but I'd sort of put it away and I hadn't thought about it a lot. And some things happened in 1977 that very forcibly brought that back to my attention. The first thing that happened was that I was in first-year law school. I'd started first-year law school in September of 77, and just a couple of months into law school, my marriage went up in flames. It was a very awful, terrible time, and it put me back into the same kind of state of suicidal depression that had got me hospitalized 14 years earlier. So I was going through my own private hell, dealing with this really terrible situation. The second thing was that purely by chance, when I'd started law school, I had agreed to spend a couple of days a week working in a student legal aid clinic, of which there were several. And I'd ended up working in the student legal aid clinic, which was stationed in Queen Street Mental Health Center. So I was looking around me at people who were currently hospitalized, and I was getting very, very upset. I was just appalled. I was thinking it's 14 years later and things haven't changed. Things are just as bad as they were back in 1963. And getting very upset by this. The third thing that happened was that in connection with one of my clients in Queen Street, a case that I was working on, I met Don Weitz. And Don had very recently, just a month or two before, started a group in Toronto, which was at that time called the Ontario Mental Patients Association. It later became known as Ontario Patient Self-Help Association, and later than that, it changed its name to On Our Own. And Don got me very interested. I started going to meetings and started meeting other people who had made their way through the system, some permanently, some temporarily, but who, among them were people who actually had a political analysis, who made me look at things in a way I hadn't looked at them before, who helped me to understand through their own experiences what some of the problems were. For example, I had ECT, as I mentioned. I had had some bad after effects from the ECT, but it never occurred to me that this was a pattern. I thought I'd just been unlucky. And then I started meeting other people who'd had ECT and who had had similar experiences, many of them far worse than my own, and started looking into it, looking into the facts and so on. And to make a long story short, I became very active in On Our Own, and although I'd gone into law school knowing I wanted to work in the area of law and medicine, it pretty rapidly narrowed down to the area of law and mental health. So both professionally and in my role as a survivor, that was taking up a good part of my life for a long time.
What other groups besides On Our Own have you been involved with?
I was on the board of HouseLink Community Homes for a period of time, which was providing housing for people coming out of hospital. I helped found ARCH, the Advocacy Resource Center for the Handicapped, and then worked at ARCH first as an articling student and then later on for another 7 years as head of litigation, doing test casework for people with disabilities, and included in that, the bulk of what I was doing was mental health work. What else? I helped found an organization called CLARE, which is a national organization now defunct, which did legal advocacy and research into areas affecting people with law and disabilities. Most of the formal kinds of things that I've been involved in have been cross-disability rather than strictly for psychiatric survivors, but the ones that were psychiatric survivors are really on our own in HouseLink.
What about the Coalition to Stop Electroshock?
Oh, the Coalition to Stop Electroshock, yes. I was a member of that. If it still existed, would probably still be a member. I started out as a very active member and spokesperson, and then ended up pulling back from that because of the fact that shortly after the coalition got going, a major electroshock case came along, which I ended up being counsel on. And it was therefore kind of difficult for me to be out expressing my personal views while I was arguing the case in court. So a lot of my energies went into that case. One of the things that came out of the case was the formation of a government committee to study the use of ECT in Ontario, and I ended up on that committee as well. I've actually been on a number of related government committees.
Could you briefly tell the story of that case, please?
Sure. My client was a young woman. Her name there's a publication ban on her name, so she's known to the legal world only as Mrs. T. Mrs. T was admitted to Hamilton Psychiatric Hospital, which incidentally was my own alma mater. That's where I spent my time. And shortly after she was admitted, she was asked to consent to electroshock. She said no. Asking her, by the way, meant that they thought she was competent to consent. And under Ontario law, if somebody's competent to consent, Ontario law at that time, which I'll be talking about, a lot of changes came out of that case. But when she refused, they went to her family to seek permission, and they went first to her husband, and her husband refused. Then they went to her father, and he refused. Then they went to her brother, and he refused. And then, as they had a right to do at that time under the law, they went to the Mental Health Review Board, and they sought an order authorizing them to administer electroshock without consent, and the board made that order. The family were all very upset, and they started hunting frantically for a lawyer who could do something about this. They were referred to me, and I took it on. It was, they came to me, they called me on a Friday, and the treatments were due to start the following Tuesday. So there was not an awful lot of time to get things launched. And what I advised them to do, and they agreed, was at that time in Ontario, there was no right of appeal to a court from the decisions of the review board. What there was, as there always is from a tribunal, is a much more limited right called the right of judicial review. That means you can't go to the court and say to the court, we think this board made a mistake and they gave the wrong decision. You can only go if the board either screwed up its procedure, didn't do something that it was supposed to do, or if the board made a ruling where it didn't have any jurisdiction to make a ruling. I remember the example one of our law professors used was if you got the milk marketing board setting beef prices, it was clearly a subject for judicial review. And I brought an application for judicial review, not on procedural grounds, because they'd done the procedure right. The argument that I brought was that the board didn't have authority to make an order for ECT because the statute specifically prohibited the board from authorizing psychosurgery. And I argued that the way psychosurgery was defined in the legislation, ECT was psychosurgery, because it was a procedure that removed, destroyed, or interrupted the continuity of histologically normal brain tissue. So what my basic argument was that ECT was brain damaging, therefore fell within the psychosurgery definition, and therefore the board could not order it. The case got an enormous amount of publicity, coast to coast. I've got clippings from Edmonton and Vancouver and Newfoundland and we had the Ontario Minister of Health standing up in the legislature and saying he was personally pretty upset about people being subjected to this treatment when nobody had consented to it. It became very hot politically. It got heard on an expedited basis in the court 5 weeks after we brought the application, during which 5 weeks, by the way, as well as carrying a full caseload, we conducted examinations of 7 expert witnesses averaging 4 to 5 hours in length each, acquired voluminous amounts of sort of medical journal articles and things. That was a place where Dawn was really helpful. I had Dawn running to the medical library all the time and photocopying stuff for me. I think I ended up with a collection of every article on ECT that had ever been written in the English language and a couple that were in other languages. To make a long story short, we lost. The judge ruled that I'd raised some really, really difficult questions, and it was clear that nobody had all the answers on this subject, but the onus of proof was on me to show that it was damaging. It wasn't on the doctors to show that it wasn't. Consequently, I hadn't pushed it over the 50% probability, and I lost. On my client's instructions, we brought an application for leave to appeal to the Court of Appeal, and before that application was heard, the ministry approached us and wanted to settle the matter.
The Ministry of Health.
And their proposal, which again was in my client's best interest, which meant I pretty much had to go along with it, was that if we dropped our application for leave to appeal, they would arrange to have Mrs. T transferred to another doctor in hospital, which would agree not to use ECT. That was done. We dropped our application. We got Mrs. T off the hook. And the ministry got what they wanted, which is that that decision stood on the books, legitimizing the board's right to order ECT. What did come of it, though, is a couple of things. The first was that almost immediately, the government proclaimed some sections of the Mental Health Act that had been passed in 1978, 4 years earlier, but never proclaimed, which did provide an awful lot more process at review board hearings, and which gave a right of appeal from the review board to the court. And the second thing that happened was that they established the ECT Review Committee, and although I wasn't one of the original members of the committee, I was added to the committee a couple of months after it started deliberating, and it produced a report which is not the be-all and the end-all of all reports on ECT, but was considerably better than one might have expected. It didn't say ECT shouldn't be used. It did register that there was one dissenter in that, which was me. It proposed a very elaborate and careful scheme of substitute decision-making, which is now part of Ontario law. It's almost word-for-word what the ECT Review Committee proposed. And it stated very strongly that unless all of the recommendations in that report were followed, there was a strong case for banning ECT in Ontario.
This made a difference to the use of ECT.
Well, it didn't immediately. Many of the recommendations have not been followed. And the topic kind of went into abeyance until about 19, I'm trying to remember if it was 86 or 87, 87, I think, when a quite, no, 86, quite remarkable thing happened. There was a bill before the legislature at that time, which is what's called an omnibus bill. It's a bill that is not there to deal with one particular issue, but is amending many, many statutes. And the reason for this bill being there was that Section 15 of the Charter had been proclaimed, and all of a sudden people realized that there were all kinds of pieces of legislation in Ontario which didn't conform with the Charter. And they did this bill to patch everything up. In its original form, it had 2 or 3 proposed amendments to the Mental Health Act. couple were sort of important but minor. For instance, it changed age of majority to age 16 throughout. It had said age of majority, and they changed it to age 16 for some charter reason which escapes me. They had one proposal that we quite liked, which was that for the first time, if your doctor said you were incompetent, you didn't have to believe him. You could go to the review board and have the doctor's decision about your competency reviewed. But other than that, there wasn't much. And a number of us were quite concerned about this, and we felt that if the Minister of Health thought that this was all that was wrong with the Mental Health Act on charter grounds, then the Minister of Health didn't know his charter very well. And one Saturday night at about 11 p.m., I sat down at the word processor in my office and drafted another proposed 22 amendments to the Mental Health Act to comply with the charter, in my view, and with the backing of a couple of other lawyers and people in the survivor movement, I went and sold them to the opposition. We were in a minority government situation at that time. It was a Liberal government, but they were in the minority. And I sold the amendments to the NDP, and what had been anticipated to be about a half-hour debate on the Mental Health Act in this bill turned into a two-week debate. We caught the doctors off guard. They weren't prepared. They kind of went hysterical that all of this stuff was now being raised. And there was a kind of a huge battle before the committee studying this bill. And when the dust had settled, there had been some very significant changes to the Mental Health Act. However, one we had lost on was that we had attacked the right of the review board to make treatment orders. We had said it ought to be good enough that, you know, you have a consent from the patient or a substitute consent from someone authorized to give it. If you don't have those, the board shouldn't be making treatment orders. We'd lost that one narrowly. This was in May of that year. The bill then kind of disappeared for a while. It didn't get back to the House for third and final reading. It was held up because there was controversy about some other things in it dealing with the Human Rights Code, specifically amendments to include sexual orientation as a prohibited ground of discrimination. And at that point, the Attorney General of Ontario was himself gay. And there was enormous concern that putting through an amendment promoting gay rights would result in a personal attack on him. So there was some stalling. But in December, the thing finally got back to the legislature. And when it did, something quite amazing happened. In the interim, the Conservatives, of all unlikely people, had picked up ECT as an issue. The Conservatives were opposed to the compulsory use of ECT.
What do you mean by compulsory?
That without consent. And anyway, when the bill got back to the House, what happened was that Evelyn Gigantes of the NDP got up at third reading, and more as a gesture than anything else, she re-proposed the amendment that would take away the board's right to make treatment orders. And the Tories got confused, and they voted for it by mistake. They thought they were voting for amendment that wouldn't let the board make treatment orders for ECT. They didn't realize they were voting for something that would not allow the board to make treatment orders at all. Well, it took them about 15 minutes to realize their error. They tried to reopen it on the floor of the legislature. That requires all-party consent, and the NDP refused to give consent. And all of a sudden, we had a bill that said that the boards couldn't make treatment orders anymore. And everybody sort of went into shock. The Tories ran off to the Liberal Minister of Health and beat their heads on the ground and said, "We're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry. How can we fix this?" The Liberal Minister of Health laughed a lot because he already had the doctors mad at him over. This was at the same time as the Liberals were pushing through a bill banning extra billing you know, you had to take your OHIP fees and that was it. And now the doctors were going to have somebody else to be mad at, like the Tories. But finally they struck a deal. And what the deal was that they would put another section into the bill delaying proclamation of this particular section until April the 1st, the most appropriate date, I thought. And that meanwhile, it would go, they were going to introduce another bill to repeal the amendment. I mean, this is like layer upon layer. So they brought forth another bill. Counsel to the Ministry of Health persuaded them, however, that if they were going to take, if they were going to give the boards back the right to make treatment orders, there had to be something to sweeten the package, and proposed what was basically the substitute consent scheme drawn from the recommendations of the ECT review committee that would have a much, much better plan for substitute decision making than what currently existed. And they figured, well, the doctors will be happy that the board gets its power back, and the patients will be happy to have this wonderful new consent scheme. What ended up, of course, was everybody was angry. The doctors hated the consent scheme, and the patients hated the boards being able to make treatment orders, and all hell broke loose. So April 1st is approaching, and the bill hasn't even got to committee yet, because committee's bogged down with other stuff. So they introduce another bill, which is going to delay proclamation of the amendment until June the 30th. And by, would you, June the 30th? No, May, end of May. End of May is approaching, and committee is now looking at this, but is nowhere near making a decision about it. So the minister decides he's going to introduce yet another bill, which will delay proclamation until the following January, because along the way it's occurred to the minister that if competent patients are going to be able to refuse, it would be a good idea if we knew how to figure out who's competent. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to delay it until the next January so that he could set up a committee that would study how you decide who's competent. Except that there was a slip-up in the minister's office, and that bill did not get on the order paper. So comes the end of May, and the amendment pops into place. Boards no longer have any authority to make any treatment orders, at which point all hell breaks loose. Panic is in the streets, and a deal is struck within 48 hours. Everybody got something out of the deal. What the NDP got is that review boards could no longer override the wishes of competent patients. What the Liberals got is review boards could still override substitutes of incompetent patients. And what the Tories got is review boards couldn't order ECT anymore. So we have the Conservative Party in Ontario to thank for that amendment.
I understand that electrical shock is nevertheless on the rise.
Yes, it is. One of the other interesting things that fell out of the ECT review committee, one of the recommendations of the committee was that there be a kind of a standardized information package about ECT, and they suggested some of the elements that should be contained in such an information package. The government has been trying for almost 10 years now to develop an information package that is acceptable both to the psychiatrists and to the survivor movement. They have predictably failed to this point. In fact, some of the versions that have come out along the way have been quite hysterically funny. The very first one, which is still my favorite, purported to describe what happens during an ECT treatment and left out the seizure. There was another version which said absolutely no memory loss, which survivors went nuts about. There was another version which laid out some of the quite awful things that can happen, and the psychiatrists went ape. In 10 years, they have not been able to come up with anything. Consequently, what you're left with is that the requirement for informed consent is boils down to the requirement for the psychiatrist to tell you what he or she thinks of ECT. And for those who give it, who I must emphasize are a minority. Only about 15% of psychiatrists use ECT, but they tend to use it a lot, and they tend to believe that it's the greatest thing since sliced bread and has no risks, and that's what they tell their patients. Well, if you're told about this wonderful miracle cure with no risks, of course you're going to consent to it. Why not? I mean, that's what I did. In fact, I actually consented without knowing very much of anything. I was horribly depressed, and the doctor said, we've got something that'll fix you up just fine. And I was never awfully clear about what was actually happening to me when I was unconscious.
And this is still standard practice that they don't give proper information and say this will make you feel better, both with ECT and with drugs.
That's right. Some places are a little better. The Clark, for instance, has information sheets about its treatment, which it gives patients, but the information is a little biased, to say the least. My own view, by the way, and what the ministry ought to do about this information sheet is, rather than try to get something that everybody can live with, they should produce a pamphlet which tells both sides of the story.
Yeah.
Here's what the doctors say, here's what the patients say, let people make up their own minds.
Yeah. What happened to the coalition to stop electroshock?
To tell you the truth, I don't exactly know. It was very active and very vocal, starting, as I said, before the Mrs. T case, through the Mrs. T case, through the committee hearings, or committee deliberations. They were very concerned, for example, that the review committee made a decision not to have public hearings. And what they did is they held their own public hearings and then took a transcript of the submissions and sent it to the committee, and it was indeed very useful. They also did a very, very fine brief to the committee, which was a study of the whole issue of ECT from a number of angles. Effectiveness research, damage research, sexist bias in the use of ECT. I should mention that ECT is given to women 2.5 to 3 times as often as men, and the standard explanation is that women are depressed 2.5 to 3 times as often as men, which is quite true because women have a lot more to be depressed about. But there are a couple of studies around that indicate that even if you're looking not at a primary diagnosis of depression, but a primary diagnosis of, say, schizophrenia, women still get it 2.5 to 3 times as often. Once the ECT review committee reported, there was one major initiative after that. The coalition actually persuaded two city councils, Toronto and the City of York, to call for a provincial moratorium on the use of ECT until the recommendations of that committee were carried out. But nothing much happened, and it just kind of disappeared. It just kind of faded away because it didn't any longer, I think, have a kind of a clear thing to do. There'd been briefs to write and submissions to make and hearings to hold, and then it didn't have a clear focus anymore, and it just sort of disintegrated.
Okay, now let me ask you, what are the flaws in Ontario's mental health act? Major flaws, as you see them.
Major flaws? The major flaw, I think, is that it exists. Given the mental health acts around the world or in North America, it's probably the best of the bunch. The question is, why do we need a mental health act at all? My friend and your friend Dawn has been pushing me for years to bring a charter challenge to the whole idea of involuntary commitment. He thinks it's a violation of the liberty provisions in the charter, and I happen to agree with him. I think it is. I also think that we are not yet at a point where a court will buy that argument, and that to bring that case prematurely is worse than not bringing it. I don't understand why societies almost universally currently see the need for special laws around people who have a mental disorder I don't mind the word disorder. I mind the term illness.
I want to say who are labeled as having a mental disorder.
Pardon?
I'm nevertheless going to say who are labeled as having a mental disorder.
All right. Who are perceived as having a mental disorder. How's that? We do not have a cancer act or an epilepsy act or anything else. And if anybody proposed that, you know, we should have ways of forcing people with cancer to be hospitalized and have treatment, I think there'd be a huge public outcry. Mm-hmm. But the perception is that somehow things that happen in your mind are different. Let me back off from that for a minute. What's the matter with the act? Other than the power to lock people up, not too much at the moment. The rules around treatment have been substantially altered, so that now, number one, as of January of next year, there will be no power to treat someone without either a personal or substitute consent, where substitute consenters are bound by wishes the person expressed when capable, where someone has the power in advance to choose who their substitute consenter will be and to instruct that substitute if they want to. We've substantially limited the power to use chemicals or anything else for restraint. The act is not bad, except that it still allows you to lock people up. I also have to say, however, that the fact that the act is now as right as it can be and still exists doesn't mean that things are happening the way they should be. We've got through, I think, the stage of playing with the legislation, and the big fight now is to enforce the legislation.
It's my contention that psychiatrists routinely do things which are illegal. Is that your perception?
Absolutely. No question about it. It happens daily in virtually every hospital with a psychiatric ward in this province. Doctors are, number one, quite unwilling to learn what the law is. I had the experience last year of going on tour with the Ontario Hospital Association, who held informational seminars in six cities to inform people about impending changes in the legislation around consent to treatment, not just psychiatric treatment, but treatment generally. And almost without exception, no doctors attended. Nurses attended, records keepers attended, administrators attended, doctors were conspicuous by their absence. This is very common. There was a report a couple of years ago out of the Ontario Official Guardian's office about their efforts to go around the province and explain their role as the substitute decision maker of last resort for psychiatric patients. And nobody showed up to most of the sessions. Doctors don't want to know this stuff. That's number one. Number two, of course, is that we're in a period of profound societal change in all kinds of ways, but one of the most important ways is that doctors are being dragged off their pedestal. Doctors have historically had the belief that MD stands for medical deity, that their judgments are not to be questioned, and psychiatrists, institutional psychiatrists, have had the additional factor that the law supported that. All doctors, doctors in every specialty or every branch of medicine, some of them have always had this doctor knows best attitude and the feeling that they can just go ahead and do stuff whether the patients really understand what's happening or not. But psychiatrists are the only ones who've had that supported by law.
Mm-hmm.
We as a society have given them officially some very significant powers, and they are resisting like crazy being dragged into what's almost the 21st century. A particular doctor whom I won't name, for example, was one of the people consulted about the recommendations of the ECT Review Committee. The Ministry of Health held a meeting to say, here are the recommendations of the committee and here's what we intend to do about it. And as he left the meeting, He turned to one of the Ministry of Health people, and he said, "You can pass whatever laws you like. We're going to do what we want." So that's still a major, major fight. And in fact, the Weber's case, which I was telling you about earlier, I think illustrates this point.
Why are psychiatrists given so much power?
I think it's a combination of two or three things. Number one, there's a tendency to see psychiatrists as experts, even in areas in which they're not expert. There's a book which I would recommend everybody interested in this area read by a man named Jonas Robitscher, who is both a psychiatrist and a lawyer. He's now dead, called The Powers of Psychiatry. Robitscher doesn't question the traditional role of psychiatry, which is to, in his view, heal the sick. But he's very concerned about the expansion of that role. He doesn't see why we use psychiatrists to decide who we should hire, or to decide who should get the kids, or to decide what was really going on with Napoleon. We tend to look to psychiatrists as experts in the human mind, and therefore well-equipped to pronounce on and deal with anything to do with the human mind. That's factor number one. They are really seen as knowledgeable about how people's heads work. Number two is that society really has an enormously stereotypical view of the crazy person. The crazy person is seen as some kind of a cross between an incompetent six-year-old child and Jack the Ripper. People are scared of crazy people. People don't want crazy people around because they don't know what they're going to do next. In fact, the incidence of violence among people with a psychiatric label is at worst no more than in the general population, and some studies have shown it's as much as 7 times lower. Your typical person labeled schizophrenic is an enormously passive individual who's never going to hurt anybody. But one of the troubles is that when you get the exceptions, and you get people who do hurt other people, they tend to do so in rather spectacular and bizarre ways. So everybody gets tarred with the brush. I don't know if you've ever read a book called Stigma by a sociologist named Irving Goffman. Goffman talks about the fact that we have, as a society, expectations of how people are going to behave. We don't, for example, expect someone to walk into a fancy restaurant and start taking their clothes off. When people violate the sort of norms of societal behavior, we're taken aback. We don't quite know how to deal with it. And one of the ways that we deal with it is by pathologizing that behavior. By not saying, here's somebody who's done something I didn't expect, but here's somebody who must be sick because he's done something I didn't expect. And we don't live comfortably with uncertainty. We want to know what the guy in the next office or the person at the next table in the restaurant is likely to do. And we get really uneasy when that person violates our expectations. Because we're uneasy with it, we pathologize it. And then because we've pathologized it, we have the expectation that because the person is unpredictable, this may lead to, at the least, embarrassment and at the worst, violence. We want somebody to do something about it. We don't want unpredictable people in our lives. And therefore, we say, let's take these unpredictable people and let's put them someplace where maybe they can be made predictable, and if they can't, at least we don't have to cope with them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, just let me ask you, how does Ontario's mental health act compare to other Canadian mental health acts?
Far better.
Give me an example of some of the serious problems with other mental health acts.
Okay. The Ontario standard for admitting somebody against their will to a psychiatric facility is that the person, as a result of a mental disorder, must present a pretty serious risk either to themselves or somebody else. One of three kinds. Either a risk of serious physical harm to themselves, suicide, self-mutilation, a risk of serious physical harm to somebody else, or they must be so incapable to care for themselves that they are at risk of imminent and serious physical impairment. The little old lady with Alzheimer's and the 23 cats in the newspapers, you know? In contrast, the Saskatchewan Act, for example, requires only for involuntary commitment that somebody believes that you are in need of care, in need of treatment. Parenthetically, the commitment rate in Ontario is 5 or 6 times that in Saskatchewan. Whether people actually get committed has very little to do with the law. Second example, in Ontario currently, a person may only be given psychiatric treatment with either their personal consent, if they're competent, or a valid substitute consent, if they're incompetent. In British Columbia, the moment you become an involuntary psychiatric patient, all treatment decisions are made by the administrator of the facility. There is not even an inquiry into whether you're capable of making your own decisions. That's a couple of examples. In the Yukon, you can be civilly committed for damaging property, even your own property.
What do you think about the concept of mental illness?
Oh, that's a tough one. I guess my present view on that is that it probably doesn't exist. I'm willing to be persuaded otherwise, given proof. I haven't yet seen any. I am not persuaded by any of the current genetic and biochemical studies. I'm not ruling it out. If somebody can give me cogent evidence, I'm willing to look at it. There is not any to date, in my view. Yes, there are biochemical effects of the problems that people have. Yes, if you get depressed, certain things happen to your body that are measurable and palpable. But those, in my view, are effects rather than causes. And the whole idea of the current vogue in psychiatry, which is to define everything as biochemical and say we don't need to talk to them, we just need to give them pills, I have an awful lot of trouble with that.